This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. This week marks the fourth anniversary of the passage of the No Child Left Behind Act. On Monday, President Bush visited an elementary school in suburban Baltimore, Maryland, to tout the school's progress as an example of the law's success. The most recent results for the act's progress are mixed, however. For example, in both elementary and middle schools, there were some gains in math scores. But in reading, the gains were modest for elementary students, and in middle school, the scores actually declined. The goal of No Child Left Behind is to improve student performance in math and science and to eliminate the performance gap between minority and white students by 2014. But school districts are struggling for all kinds of reasons: not enough money, little or more, no commitment to the law's mandates, and a reluctance to adopt tougher standards and tests. Later in the program, we will find out why British drivers will soon be losing their anonymity. But first, No Child Left Behind, 4 years old. If you work in a school, we'd like to hear from you. How has the law changed what you do? Do you think things are improving? Is it making a difference from the Department of Education? And we'll be taking questions only in the form of email. You can send those to TOTN at NPR.org. Later, we'll be joined by NPR's education correspondent, and we will take your calls. And so when you can call, that's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can call anytime. And right now, though, David Dunn is here. David Dunn is chief of staff to the U.S. Secretary of Education, joins us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Frank. Thanks for having me.
4 years ago, and we're 4 years into No Child Left Behind. What does the Department of Education say about where the country's public schools are right now?
Well, we think we're clearly headed in the right direction, Frank. Some of the results from the nation's report card, the National Assessment of Education Progress that you mentioned earlier, clearly indicate that. For America's nine-year-olds in reading, there's been more progress in the last 5 years than in the previous three decades combined. And achievement gaps in reading and math between white and African-American nine-year-olds and also between white and Hispanic nine-year-olds are at an all-time low. Math scores for African-Americans and Hispanic 13-year-olds reached an all-time high this past year. So clearly we're headed in the right direction. Unquestionably, we've got a long way to go. The law calls to have all students scoring proficiency in both reading and math by the year 2013-2014, and we're a long way from there, but we're headed in the right direction, and we're very, very pleased with the progress.
Reading in particular seems to be a weak point, particularly in middle schools where the scores have declined. Do you see an extra effort needed in that area, in the area of reading?
Well, and clearly there are some extra efforts that are needed there, and that's why the president has quadrupled funding for the Reading First program since he took office. Reading for the explicit goal of No Child Left Behind is to have all students reading on grade level by the time they're in the third grade, and then staying on grade level. And so the Reading First program is a massive effort to have scientifically based reading instruction provided in schools throughout the country. Reading instruction that has been proven by extensive evaluation and research to be effective in getting kids to read on grade level.
Now, another area that one of the objectives of the program is to eliminate the gap between white kids and minority students by 2014. There are mixed results in this area, too. Again, some studies showing some very marginal gains. Is it still realistic to expect that you're going to meet this goal?
We absolutely think so, Frank. As I said earlier, the gap between African American and white peers and Hispanic and white peers at nine-year-olds is at an all-time low. Is there a lot of more progress that needs to be made? Clearly, there is. But we're definitely headed in the right direction and feeling good about that. And parents and teachers and school administrators across the country should be very proud of the effort.
Talking with David Dunn, Chief of Staff to the Secretary of Education, as we review No Child Left Behind in its fourth year today on Talk of the Nation. And joining us now in the studio is NPR's education correspondent, Claudio Sanchez. Hello, Claudio.
Hi, Frank.
Walk us through the No Child Left Behind Act, this legislation. It's about measuring student performance and holding schools accountable. What are the consequences, Claudio?
Clearly the key provisions are requirements that states assess student progress in math and in reading each year in grades 3 through 8, and then once again in high school. And those schools that that fail to meet the state-set targets, and that is an important point to make. No Child Left Behind clearly recognizes the importance of state and local decision-making in the area of education and does not try to establish a national curriculum or drive instructional methods from Washington, D.C., but rather requires states to set standards for all grades and all in reading and math, to measure annual student progress towards proficiency, and then requires, as Frank said earlier, that all students are performing at the proficient level by the year 2013-2014.
Well, Claudius,
I couldn't have said it better myself. This is Claudio Sanchez. I guess my take on it, Frank, is that, you know, No Child Left Behind was a sea change, certainly in federal education policy and its role in helping improve schools. Was it necessary? Absolutely. I don't think you find very many people out there who say that there wasn't a need for a deliberate plan, a blueprint to improve schools, especially for low-income kids of color, Black, Latinos, who have essentially been camouflaged in terms of their performance over the years because, you know, their scores were always averaged out somehow in schools, even good schools, where they weren't doing well. And yet we never really knew how they were doing. Now this law essentially does something very, very important, which is to break down the data. Data is important here. The data says that if you break down, you know, how these kids are doing in reading and math, you're going to see failure. You're going to see why some of the policies in schools these days don't work for them and why we should do more. Here's the notion, though, that is right now at issue, and that is whether the goal is realistic of having kids be proficient, largely meaning at grade level, by the year 2013-14. The notion that schools alone can create equal achievement for children of different social backgrounds is in many ways not based on any true understanding of the factors that contribute to these kids' education. And if you ask any classroom teacher out there what contributes to Johnny's or Pablo's academic gains over the next year, it's not just whether that teacher expects that kid to succeed. It's how's it kids, this kid doing outside of school, beyond the school? How is the family doing? Are the parents, do they have a living wage? Do they have a decent, stable home in which to live? And I think that we sometimes forget that the most difficult kids to teach face enormous challenges outside school and that the schools in large part don't have any control over. And I think the issue these days is, can these kids get to proficiency given that the larger social questions, the safety net for these kids is not there yet?
David Dunn, that was the critique 4 years ago and has remained the critique, but now you've had 4 years to evaluate the results. Is there anything in the evidence that you've seen over these past 4 years that suggests that those critics may not have been right, that you can address schools as schools absent the kind of social problems that created the gap in the first place?
Absolutely, Frank. And no one would suggest that some of the issues and circumstances that Claudio were laying out are not legitimate and that need to be issues and challenges that schools and students and teachers need to grapple with. But you know, we talked about the progress and the fact that we're headed in the right direction a minute ago. More importantly, perhaps, the secretary and the president, others in the Department of Education, have visited schools across the country from Maryland to Washington to Chicago to Mission, Texas, mm-hmm. and schools in which these kids are achieving now, and they are approaching 100% proficiency. With good reading instruction, good mathematics instruction, we're seeing over and over in schools around the country that these students can, all students, can achieve and can be proficient. And let me just address one myth, if you will, in terms of No Child Left Behind, and that's, I think Claudio used the term equal achievement. No Child Left Behind does not require or establish equal achievement. It says that all students should be achieving on proficiency, on grade level, as Claudio said, in every grade in reading and math. We clearly, many, many students will continue to achieve at higher levels. just as they are now. We recognize that in some, for some students, they may achieve proficiency. They may need a little more time to achieve proficiency, and that's why Secretary Spellings has come out with some proposed modifications around special education.
Well, I want to talk to
English proficiency
to more a little bit more about this business of proficiency and what standard we use, because there has been one of the complaints was that the standard was the standards were so uneven, that the state standards and the federal standard were so uneven that's essentially forced the federal government to revise those standards, and in fact states have been in effect dumbing down their standards in order to not look so bad.
Well, firstly, there are no national standards. OCHLF behind clearly puts the responsibility for setting standards on the states, working with teachers and educators and the community at the state level to identify what skills are necessary to be considered proficient for third graders in the various grades.
But there is a national test, score against which state standards are measured. So if I tell you, yeah, we're doing great here in Virginia, 90% of our kids are meeting the test, and you say, oh, no, not according to our standard, that has been a point of contention,
right.
Has it not?
The NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, I mentioned before, is a national test. It, prior to No Child Left Behind, it was a voluntary assessment. No Child Left Behind requires all 50 states to participate in this assessment in reading and math in grades 4 and 8. And clearly there are differences among the states in terms of the standards that they set and the assessments in the NAEP. And that's one of the reasons that the NAEP is required, so that there will be a sort of an alignment or a check on states, so that if states really are lowering their standards, they'll that will be reflected in the NAEP over time.
All right, David Dunn, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Frank.
David Dunn is Chief of Staff for the U.S. Secretary of Education. We're talking today about No Child Left Behind. 4 years old, our number is 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. No Child Left Behind became law 4 years ago this week. Its aim to raise test scores and to close the achievement gap between rich and poor, white and minority students. So how's it working? Well, if you're a teacher, what impact has No Child Left Behind had on your school, or an administrator? Give us a call here at 800-989-8255. Parents, we'd like you to chime in too. Has it helped? Has it made things worse? No change. Give us a call. TOTN@npr.org is the email address. The number 800-989-8255. NPR's education correspondent Claudio Sanchez is with us. And we're joined now by Ross Wiener, who is the policy director at the Education Trust. It's a liberal advocacy organization here in Washington, D.C., and he joins us in Studio 3A. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
You actually, your group supports No Child Left Behind. I want to get this all out in terms of fair disclosure here, and the Economic Trust at the same time has analyzed data to assess No Child Left Behind. What does your analysis show?
Well, I think we've heard some of the general context already. I mean, I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that No Child Left Behind really represents the first time that we're focusing on all kids, that we're having a really important national conversation about what we need to happen in public education to serve our democracy, to serve our society, and to really fulfill the potential of public education and of our democratic ideals. So I think that's the sort of most important context. And then it's true, we have been looking at the data to try and keep track of where things are going. And I think we've heard we're making some modest gains, especially in the elementary grades, especially in mathematics. The secondary schools and especially the high schools remain a big challenge. And that even where we're making gains, we really need to accelerate progress. And we really have to keep in perspective what we can expect from No Child Left Behind and what we're going to need to do otherwise. This is a part of a really massive undertaking to reform public education, and I think we have to think about it as part of a long-term strategy. And it really has three big components. The first has to be changing the belief systems and the expectations about what's possible in public education. And then the second part has to be then changing practices and changing resource allocations and making sure that schools educating poor kids get more help and support, more resources, better quality teachers. And then the third part, hopefully, will be seeing the increased student achievement that all of us want and the narrowing of those achievement gaps.
Sure, but I mean, that's the buy low, sell high part of the equation, isn't it? I mean, that's what you, where you want to get, but the devil's in the details. How do you get there? We've had 4 years with this particular program. So what does your data show?
Well, again, the data shows that with respect to elementary schools and mathematics, there's a very positive story. Every group of students is performing at the highest level that we've ever measured for the country, and the gaps are as small as they've ever been. Now, the achievement gaps are still very big, and I think, you know, the speakers previously have acknowledged some students face much bigger challenges and obstacles outside of school than other kids, and they present much bigger challenges to public education. I think what most of the public doesn't yet understand is that our public schools, instead of confronting those inequalities that students face outside of school, often exacerbate those inequalities so that we take the kids who have the least outside of school and we give them the least in school as well, the least qualified and experienced teachers, the less access to rigorous curriculum, and our research shows we even spend less money on those kids. Again, No Child Left Behind is putting pressure on systems to change those patterns of inequality, but that's a conversation that's really active right now, and we're really going to need to change those patterns of inequality and to get the better results
we want. Well, let's talk some more about the pressure points. Joining us now to do that is Joel Packer. He's manager for elementary and secondary education, ACT policy at the National Education Association. He's also in Studio 3A. Joel, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And do I have this right? Your organization's position is No Child Left Behind. You support the goals, but you do think there are some flaws in how it's written.
Absolutely. The No Child Left Behind Act, I think, could be summed up in a lot of ways as at least a partially failed experiment. The goals are fine. We agree with the goals, improving student achievement, closing achievement gaps, but it's one-size-fits-all approach. It's overly punitive approach of taking some money away from schools that don't meet these standards. We think, if anything, might have diverted efforts away from classroom practices that were working to spending more money on testing and bureaucracy.
Let's go to the phones. Michael is on the line from Colorado. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, actually, the point that the speaker just made a moment ago is what I would like to touch on. I'm in a small rural school district, and we received a $1 million grant called the Reading First Grant for the next 3 years to improve the achievement of elementary school kids. And this $1 million a year grant, for the most part, we received a half a dozen boxes of books, and twice a month the school is closed and the teachers go to a conference room and receive additional training. It doesn't seem like that we got much for the money. Now, we had a choice of five or six curriculums to choose from, and these are all publishing companies who are recording windfall, you know, record profits since this act was passed into law, and they make very large campaign contributions as well.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Michael. The decision to spend, you got the money from the federal government as part of No Child Left Behind. Is that part right?
Yeah.
And so the money's there. And then the question of how you spend it becomes a very local decision, doesn't it?
No, not at all. We had six curriculums to choose from. These were all major publishing companies.
So that was part of the, that came, that was one of the strings
attached
to
the money. Yeah, you don't actually ever see any of the money. We could have hired 40 reading tutors for the same money, but that wasn't an option.
All right. Well, let's get a comment on that, Michael. And Claudio Sanchez, I'd like to ask you how much of that money is attached to those kind of restrictions?
Actually, the caller makes a good point. I mean, restrictions, and the strings attached to a lot of or some of the federal aid are a problem. Remember that the rhetoric initially was locals know best. I mean, that's what we've been hearing forever, that locals, local school boards, local teachers, classroom teachers, the people in the trenches know best. And yet, there's a big question as to whether this law is either too prescriptive or whether it's allowing states to go back. In fact, if they've had to abandon successful practices, you know, how easy is it for some of these states to continue those, given that the mandates of the law become and have become, and certainly among both Republican and Democratic governors, these are prescriptive. These are mandates that are, in some cases, in their views, unfunded, or they're essentially forcing school boards and locals to adopt practices that they may not even agree with. And once you tie money to these things, it's very hard to unbundle that money to spend on things that may be working better.
Ross Wiener at the Education Trust.
Well, the Reading First money is a very particular, and it's true, I think, a fairly prescriptive program. You know, we went, there's been tremendous research in how children learn how to read, and we're talking specifically about early elementary and primary reading instruction. And yet, there were a lot of ideological battles that were continuing that were persisting even when we actually had some pretty clear understandings.
And
of
the Bush
at least
administration pushed very heavily for phonics-based literature.
And there is a very live controversy about whether Reading First was too prescriptive and, in fact, whether sort of cronyism has had infiltrated how that money got passed out. But that is that's a very particular program within NCLB. And the fact is that the large amounts of money that come to states and school districts and to local schools through Title I, through Title II, to focus on teacher quality, really are largely unrestricted. State and local officials have tremendous discretion as to how to use those resources.
That said, Joel Packer, the other complaint that we hear so often is that there is not enough money to meet these mandates.
Right. I mean, the problem is, first of all, that because, again, No Child Behind bases everything on two test scores, the statewide reading test, the statewide math test, it has really restricted and limited what schools can do because they have to put all their efforts into boosting these test scores. So it's resulted in narrowing the curriculum. It's resulted in ever more time on test preparation. And there's been a lot of studies about that. At the same time, once a school doesn't meet these standards, they are put in a situation where if they don't improve, at least on the test scores, they are subject to ever greater consequences, eventually being taken over by the state or having all their staff replaced. It does take money, we believe, to put in place proven programs to improve instruction and improve achievement, things like smaller class sizes, after-school programs, professional development and teacher training programs. So we're imposing ever-increasing mandates on schools, but if anything, the resources are going down. The Congress just in December cut funding for No Child Left Behind by $1 billion.
Let's go out to Epping, New Hampshire. Amanda's on the line. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, good afternoon. One of the things that I wanted to add to that was I teach in Massachusetts, and we were given our calendar for the state MCAS testing. We have 5 weeks of testing that takes a chunk out of our year. And I just, to get our children to succeed, 5 weeks is an awful lot of time to devote to taking tests. It impacts, I think, what the classroom teachers do. And I'm a music teacher, and my question is, with diminishing resources, what kind of safeguards are in place for the science teachers, the tech ed teachers, and the arts, and the subject areas that help contribute to children's success in reading and math and pattern development and just becoming whole humans? We sort of, because we're not important to the proficiencies, kind of get left by the wayside. Are there any protections for if we're not English and we're not math?
Right. Let's put the question to Claudia Sanchez. Thank you, Amanda.
I suppose I've heard Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings make the argument that, you know, it's ridiculous to say that by somehow focusing on reading and math, we're shortchanging and cheating these kids, that they're somehow going to be dumb and everything else. I agree with her partially that, you know, reading is the avenue, certainly the skill that is going to get these kids to do well in other subjects. Whether there's been too much attention paid to, you know, to reading or, you know, to testing kids on reading at the expense of other things, I think, you know, it depends on where you go. I mean, some schools have actually used this law to concentrate on the right things given their population. On the other hand, if you go to a lot of suburban schools where kids are actually reading well above the grade level and because they've got books at home. They've got resources at home. Their families are, you know, are provide them with an enormous amount of help outside of school. Then you have teachers, certainly, and educators and parents who complain that the law is dumbing everything down, that this is the cookie cutter approach, and that this is somehow a step backwards because, you know, their expectations, their achievement levels are somehow suffering. I think there is a lot of truth to that as well.
Ross Wiener?
Well, there's two responses to that. I mean, first, when you look at some of the suburban districts that are talking about that, these are places that we were talking about a little bit before that never focused on their achievement gaps before. And all of a sudden, these kids are no longer invisible. And they're having to recognize that they have never really focused on educating their African-American, their Latino, their low-income kids. And so this is resulting in some very positive and important changes in those communities. But the other thing I wanted to mention is that we spend a lot of time looking at and trying to understand what's going on in high-performing, high-poverty schools. And the fact is, the first thing to know is there's actually a lot of them. And the second thing to know is that they are very dynamic, engaging places. They are not places that are inordinately focused on test preparation. These are not places that have really narrowed the curriculum. These are places that are doing everything that it takes to really connect with the kids, to make the learning relevant to their lives, and to really take them to much higher levels of achievement than we've seen as a regular practice.
We are talking today about the No Child Left Behind Act and the law that's been in effect for 4 years. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stachow. My guests are Ross Wiener, Policy Director at the Education Trust. Joel Packer is National Education Association Manager for Elementary and Secondary Education Policy. And Claudio Sanchez, NPR Education Correspondent, is with us as well. Taking your calls at 800-989-8255.
I was going to interject, Frank, that, you know, and I know you've seen this, Ross, in the data recently. I mean, the study of 11 large urban school systems recently is very revealing. The fact is that minority, low-achieving kids, low-income kids are often concentrated in these large systems. And what we're seeing is that based on NAEP scores, and these kids are improving.
NAEP scores are the national
right, the voluntary national test, although not voluntary anymore, the national test that is somewhat of a litmus test to make sure that state tests are on the up and up. But, you know, I mean, we've seen some improvement in reading and math among these urban school systems or these students. But these inner city minority kids continue to perform well below, and you've said this before, Ross, well below the national average. The percentage of fourth graders performing below basic in math, for example, grew in Atlanta, Chicago, Cleveland, Los Angeles, the District of Columbia. I believe only Austin and Charlotte in North Carolina exceeded the national average in math. So we have a concentration of kids that are not performing well, and yet, you know, they're getting lost in the averages that certainly the administration would like to put out there. That was essentially what we were not supposed to do.
Right, and in fact, this, if anything, I mean, No Child Behind was its whole purpose was to boost test scores. I think, as Claudia just said, there's been, at best, very modest increases in test scores. A lot of places the gap hasn't closed at all, so it's not even succeeding in what its intended goal was. Also, we're starting to find ever-increasing numbers of schools not meeting the federal standards. We're releasing today at NEA, it'll be on our website at NEA.org, analysis of the state data on adequate yearly progress, as it's called. There's going to be about 23,000 schools nationwide this year that will have failed the federal standards, with many studies projecting over time between 75% and 99% of all schools will likely fail. That's an irrational standard, then.
Let's go to the phones. Dave is on the line from Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave.
How are you?
Good.
I'm an educational researcher and also a longtime educator, and one of the things that I understand clearly about No Child Left Behind is any legislation passed should either improve learning for students or assist teachers and improve their teaching. There's nothing in No Child Left Behind that does either of those. When I go in to see the doctor and he takes my temperature and he says, you have a temperature, and sends me out the door, there's no help. And that's what we get with these assessments. You take the temperature, but you don't help them. So I agree that the issue of assessment ought to be within the classroom. It doesn't belong and the legislature. It belongs in each individual classroom.
All right. Ross Wiener?
Well, a couple of things. Going back, there's no question that far too many of kids in our big urban districts are low performing, and they're not getting the kind of education that they need. One thing to note is that NAEP is voluntary in the sense that those big urban districts decided they wanted to participate and get scores so that they could benchmark themselves against one another. And I think it's indicative of a real seriousness of purpose and a real energy in the big districts to try and turn things around for these kids right now. And so I'm hopeful that we'll see some progress. What some of that reflects, though, is that for a very long time, the states neglected their big cities. They expected low performance from kids in those cities, and they didn't either provide the resources or the kind of policies that would have supported higher achievement.
It's the report card on No Child Left Behind today on Talk of the Nation. You're invited to join the conversation at 800-989-8255. Our conversation continues. Stay with us. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking about No Child Left Behind and how it has changed the way your school is run. Our guests are NPR education correspondent Claudio Sanchez. Ross Wiener is policy director at the Education Trust. Joel Packer is with the National Education Association. And let's get right to your calls at 800-989-8255 with Layla on the line from St. Petersburg. Hi, Layla.
Hi, it's actually Leia.
I'm sorry.
The reason I'm calling, I teach writing at the college level. And one of the things that I've noticed is that when you focus on skills-based testing, when the focus is getting the kids to pass the test to prove that they can do A, B, or C, what you lose is the most important thing, and that is critical thinking and critical reading and critical writing skills, so that students are able to pass the test, but they are unable to think beyond where the test limits them. Yeah. And I think that that's going to that makes a difference. We don't have educated students anymore. We have skilled students, and there's a very big difference there.
Well, let me put that one first, too, and thank you, Leia, for the phone call. Ross Wiener, is that one of the inherent problems in this particular method?
Well, it certainly is a real concern, but you can absolutely design tests that are more sophisticated, that get to critical reasoning skills, comprehension, writing. And one of the concerns is that as every state has to develop its own standards, its own assessment systems, there is a lot of pressure to minimize those costs and that they end up developing tests that are more multiple choice. There are, however, states that have made different decisions, have much richer tests with much more writing that get more at those critical thinking and reasoning skills. And it is very important to make that case to policymakers to make sure that they understand our end goal is not just sort of rote skills, but learned.
Joel Packer, do you think that we can get at this critical skills issue through better tests?
I think better tests are a key need, but I think the issue is, again, multiple measures of achievement. It's just like the person before said, when they go into the doctor, they take their temperature. I want my doctor to check my blood pressure and listen to my heart as well. Just like with education, there should be state tests. We should also include local assessments. We should look at high school graduation rates, how many kids are taking advanced classes, et cetera. We also respond to what Leia said. We really need to essentially create enthusiasm in schools and engage students so that they do get the higher order thinking skills, that we do foster creativity and independence, which are equally important as memorization of facts on tests.
You know, let me pose that to Ross, because earlier, Ross, you were talking about high-achieving schools that had high minority populations or high-poverty areas. In other words, there are some schools that are doing things right. Was there anything about No Child Left Behind that created this environment, about the energy that you say is necessary for a good education?
Well, the No Child Left Behind law does not turn things around in an individual school. What it does do is elevates the importance of these issues for public consideration, and it puts some pressure on education leaders and policymakers to take these issues more seriously. And so can these improvement strategies be implemented without regard to No Child Left Behind? Absolutely. Are policymakers and education leaders more likely to take these improvement responsibilities more seriously because of the law? There's no question about it. And if I could just a quick sort of statewide example, Michigan has more schools in the last phase, the restructuring phase, than any other state, in part because of their pre-existing accountability system. But they didn't do a whole lot to actually turn things around in those persistently low-performing schools before the No Child Left Behind Act. What we saw last year was that 85% of those persistently currently low-performing schools in Michigan actually made their accountability targets for the first time in a number of years. And I think part of the reason is that state and local officials realized they had a responsibility and that there were people were going to be paying attention now in a way they hadn't in the past.
Let's go out to Kansas City, Kansas. Jay is on the line. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I've got a question regarding students that have special needs, so special education populations. How is No Child Left Behind dealing with those populations? I mean, how might we expect to get a seventh grader with severe autism ever to be reading at grade level? Because it strikes me that if that population fails, it could essentially bring down a school that is otherwise doing quite well.
All right, Jay, thank you. I'll start with Joel Packer at the NEA.
That's been an area that's been extremely problematic for the law, both that group of students and students with limited English proficient skills. The reality is that the Secretary of Education, the previous Secretary, and the current Secretary finally acknowledged there were issues with those groups of students, particularly with students with disabilities. They now are allowing, though, in a somewhat complicated and confusing way, students with disabilities to take a test based on a different set of standards, sort of geared to their cognitive abilities, but it's still very confusing. A lot of people think it's still not flexible enough and doesn't focus enough on the individual child's academic abilities.
Frank, you know, the federal government recognizes, if I believe I'm correct, about 13 categories of special needs or special correct. Education categories, and the caller referred to autism. Well, I don't think anybody who's reasonable about this will expect a kid with severe autism to perform well on a standard, state standard tests on math or reading. What I think has happened, though, is that you're right, Joe. The Secretary of Education, the Bush administration, has said, look, this is a ticking time bomb if we're going to begin to demand that, you know, most, if not all, of these special ed kids, and some schools have many of them, others don't have, you know, if we expect them to perform just as well as regular kids. And I think that it's too early to know whether the changes that have been suggested, and that is that, you know, you can give some of these kids alternative tests, and that even if they do fail, they won't count towards the overall evaluation of the school. I think that's been a reasonable thing to do. How many special education students, however, are being asked or expected to perform well on standardized tests is a huge question that is very troublesome, and it also gets to the question of cost. These are kids that are costing a lot of money, and school systems, you know, that are having to spend money just to show that these kids aren't up to speed, I think have a reason to gripe.
The notion of expectations has come up many times. We've had 4 years' experience with the law now, and Claudia, you've reported on the change in the standards, how the feds have essentially been negotiating with the states on, in effect, changing the standard because there is a realization that the initial standards may have been too high.
And, in fact, in talking to folks at the Education Trust, to folks like Ross Wiener, you know, there is a lingering fear that there's a slippery road, that the Secretary of Education has made so many concessions on, you know, whether, I mean, in the end, we're going to hold schools accountable for the results. But it's not just test scores. It's also, you know, teacher quality. It's, you know, a whole range of issues on teacher preparation, especially, you know, that have caused a great deal of heartache. And it's unclear whether these concessions are a slippery road or not. I don't know if Ross has any other views on this, but, you know, there's a reason for concern.
Well, let me just, before Ross answers that, because we're just about out of time on this, and I just want to make sure that we are clear on what happens now to No Child Left Behind. 2007, the bill is up for reauthorization. Claudia, is that right?
I'll quote, I guess, Congressman George Miller, a Democrat of California, who was a key architect of the law. As you all recall, the Democrats signed on to this law and very much supported it, and to some degree they still do. But, you know, he said to us not long ago that the goal and the deadline of No Child Left Behind will prove to be less important than the fundamental changes taking root in many schools and in the way we hold these schools accountable over the long term.
So the conversation is underway. The details are still under negotiation. And I want to thank all of you for joining the conversation. Claudia Sanchez, NPR education correspondent, thank you.
Welcome.
All right. And Ross Wiener, policy director at the Education Trust, thank you.
Thanks very much.
And Joel Packer, National Education Association, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, Big Brother's getting bigger in Great Britain. Stay with us.